From the office to a first date, there's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world that you stay you wherever you go. They combine timeless style with modern performance materials to keep you looking good and feeling comfortable all day, no matter what's on today's agenda. Browse everything from shorts and polos to sweats and crews. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com, promo code MACK25.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome my colleague Brandon Weikert. In 2022, Brandon published The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy. We've had occasion to speak of this off and on over these last years. Now, however, Brandon has the early reporting from the region. Fog of war, we're very careful here. You hear reports and you can't confirm them during the conflict. But there is enough for Brandon to measure what he saw in 22, what we're seeing in 25, both consistent and questions to be answered about the government in Tehran, about the relationship between the Council of Experts, that's the Ayatollah's group, and the military now decapitated, and especially about outside powers, that would be Russia, China, and the United States chiefly, watching a conflict break out when there were already three or four wars underway. Brandon, a very good evening to you. The shadow war saw a future of disorder. We're living in it. What did you see then that you can see now? What did you see then that we haven't seen yet? Good evening to you, Brandon.
Good evening, John. And yes, just don't call me Cassandra, but I did see the grand strategic picture shaping out as early as 2022. Basically, the Iranian regime was doing its level best to prevent the finalization of the Trump first term Abraham Accords. And they were basically lining up all of their proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis. They were lining them up to try to trigger what I called in the book the Third Intifada, which was 10-7, the 10-7 attacks. This was designed not only to hurt Israel, but it was designed to prevent the final coalescence of the Israeli-Sunni-Arab alliance. It complicated things. But the Israelis certainly have had a rough go in the last few years in response. But ultimately, the Israelis were able to hold on and then pivot and counterattack. And that counterattack has finally come in the form of these very successful at the tactical level airstrikes against Iranian nuclear weapons targets, as well as Iranian military leaders and nuclear scientists. And so now what we're seeing, as Iran struggles to retaliate, and they are retaliating, but it's not with the full force that everybody thought they would have. What we're seeing is that Israel has allies and Iran does not. Ultimately, Hezbollah has said they're sitting this one out, which is very interesting considering they're an Iranian proxy. The Houthis are talking about doing things and they fired some missiles here and there. They're not fully coming back, though, retaliatory wise. And Hamas, of course, is still weakened from the war in Gaza. The Americans, the British, apparently NATO refueling tankers have been helping the Israeli airstrikes. The Americans and British, as well as Jordanian and Saudi Air Force planes, have been working overtime to shoot down Iranian drones and missiles that are being fired now at Israel in retaliation for the initial strikes. So what this says to me, and this is what I saw back then, was that the pieces on the Middle East board were being maneuvered for what I believed was going to be the largest regional war in decades. And I think that's what's playing out now.
We'll begin with two parts of the offensive from the first hours. The first part is decapitation, the destruction of the leadership in the IRGC and in the regular army, and also what looks to be Joint Chiefs of Staff equivalent. I believe one Air Force general was wounded and not killed. Yeah. We're looking at a strike that was possible from the air, but much more useful if it was confirmed on the ground. And that brings in the question of agents inside Iran acting. What do we know about the decapitation? Was it from the air? Is Israel saying it's from the air? Or are they not commenting on how it was done?
The official story is that they are using air-to-surface missiles, that they are basically launching these attacks from the sky. In many cases, it's important to note, because we talked a lot at the beginning of the war about the suppression of Iranian air defenses, and they were, and that suppression was very good, but it wasn't total. And what we notice, and what I've been looking at in the aftermath, is a lot of beyond visual range BVR weapons were used by Israel to hit these targets. They were fired from airplanes operating in places like Iraq, so outside of the Iranian air defense bubble, and they were fired into Iran, notably Tehran. So in many cases, they were using distance as safety. But in terms of the actual sabotage, we know that Mossad did secret many of their agents for weeks and months before the conflict to sabotage the Iranian air defense network, to sabotage their missile complex, to stunt any effective retaliatory strike on Israel. We also know, and I've heard this from many sources of mine inside Israel, we know for a fact that Mossad has agents at the highest levels of the Iranian regime that are in physical close proximity to top-tier leaders, and that they are basically relaying in real time the location of these leaders, which is how the Israelis are able to surgically strike these targets and kill so many of the leadership in Iran.
The confirmation of the deaths, has Iran confirmed the ones that Israel has claimed? Has there been any gap in this? And especially about the elders, the political elders, the Council of Experts, and the Ayatollah and his son Mojtabai, who's said to be the heir apparent. Have we seen anything confirmed about them? I'm often on headlines. President Trump says, Prime Minister Netanyahu says, back and forth. What do we know that's confirmed?
Well, we do know the Iranians have confirmed the deaths of those military leaders. They've confirmed the death of the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps. They've confirmed the deaths of multiple top-ranked nuclear scientists. Everything else about the political leaders that are being supposedly targeted is rumor. I have not seen any confirmation yet on the deaths of any political leaders. I do know that Netanyahu attempted to initiate a strike against the suspected location of Ayatollah Khamenei. And according to the Telegraph yesterday, the front page article there said that Trump at the last minute overrode Netanyahu's request to launch direct strikes against the Ayatollah Khamenei, which would have been the truest sense of decapitation. But it is my contention, John, that this is not just about knocking out the nuclear weapons sites. I think this is regime change by another name. And if you look at the fact that more targets that have been destroyed are personnel rather than technical targets, that to me indicates that the Israelis are really gunning hard for putting all the toothpaste back in the tube, if you will.
Now we turn to the other part of the mission, which was the Islamic Republic of Iran's suspect nuclear weapons program. Three sites have been named in the news: Natanz, Parchin, and Fordo. Natanz and Parchin are reported destroyed, although question mark whether they were destroyed to not be reconstituted or destroyed because it takes the centrifuges offline. Unclear to me. Fordo, however, looks to be the piece that the Israeli Air Force has said over these last weeks was not prepared to handle by itself because of, one, they don't have the airframes to carry, two, the bunker busters that would be necessary. It has a technical name, but it's a big bomb. Yeah. Now, what do we know about Parchin and Natanz, their status, and then Fordo?
So I was assured battle damage assessments would be released the night of. They never were. Not that I can tell. Nothing reliable. It is my contention that the Israelis lack the proper bunker-busting bombs to permanently destroy the facilities in question. I believe the biggest bomb they used so far was a 5,000-pound bomb. These systems the Israelis are using are very effective at surface and subsurface strikes, and they have effectively destroyed the centrifuge facility at Natanz. They've done the centrifuge hall. They've done damage to the subsurface level at Natanz, which has basically disabled it. Whether the Iranians will have the capacity to rebuild, who knows, because the war continues. But ultimately, to fully destroy the targets in question, They need the 30,000-pound GBU-57 Massive Ordnance Penetrator. The U.S. will not hand that over. And Fordo is probably the most hardened of the facilities. I have heard, again, this is all fog of war rumors, I have heard that U.S. Delta Force was deployed to laze targets at Fordo in the last 48 hours for Israeli Air Force. I do not know if that is accurate. We do know there were strikes, large strikes conducted. These were re-strikes on Fordo because the initial strikes were not effective. So it is my contention here that the Israelis have done a very significant job of harming the nuclear sites, but without those massive ordnance penetrators and U.S. assistance, they cannot totally destroy them.
And the Islamic Republic of Iran's suspect nuclear weapons program. The Financial Times this morning has a column by an editor to suggest that there's no evidence that Iran was building a bomb. That's the way they say it. I mean, I could read the quote, but that's right. Where they come to. They say, right. Yes, they were enriching uranium. Yes, yeah. The suspension of the JCPOA by the previous Trump administration triggered the acceleration to 60%. Yes, at 60%, they can reach 90 necessary for a bomb in X number of days or weeks. And however, no, there's no evidence of weaponization, which would require miniaturization, the building yes. of a warhead that could be mounted on a missile. Otherwise, you've just got a bomb sitting there in your
yes.
in your lab. And the FT says that now the payoff is the regime that survives will drive right to a nuclear weapon. So those are several parts of that remark this morning. It's not all politics. This is the UK speaking. So they have no dog in the fight about partisanship. They're looking at it from the European point of view and also from a point of view that is not presumptively disposed towards Israel. So how do you measure that statement that they didn't have a bomb program?
Well, it aligns with the official assessment of the U.S. intelligence community at the end of March. Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, she said that that was the combined assessment of the U.S. intelligence community, that they were not working in Iran on a bomb, that they hadn't been working on it since 2003. So take from that what you will, that they're just mirroring what the U.S. intelligence has said. I do think they probably in Iran had a handful of rudimentary nuclear weapons. But again, like you noted and the FT noted, miniaturization is key. Without the miniaturization capacity, you can't launch the thing on a missile. And I saw no evidence, and I pointed this out in my book, the only thing I did not see evidence of was capability for miniaturization. That is a very technical capability. The North Koreans got it in 2013, but they're not sharing it with the Iranians. So there probably were some rudimentary bombs, in my opinion, but those systems were never deployed. And I think we should be looking at our intelligence. We're going to have to do a real after-action review because for 30-plus years, we were told the bomb was there and they were coming. They never came, and perhaps they never even did have the bomb. We don't know for sure.
Brendan Weikert, the author of, what is a word that's more than prescient? The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy. 2022. I recommend it as a primer to where we're going next, which is there are two possibilities. The regime survives, the regime doesn't. We'll work with both of them when we come back.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. Once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.